one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when we appear to be in the very midst of a great and unnecessary debate. We should be debating other things. We are debating right now whether it is appropriate for the President of the United States to issue a vaccine mandate. One of the greatest teachers of the Constitution, who has taught constitutional law for some 50 years at Harvard Law School, is Alan Dershowitz. He is active in litigation, tremendously active in writing. He's done, I think it's close to 50 books. Is that right, Alan?
This is my 48th on the vaccine mandate, 48, but I've done six in the last 2 years. I've really been on a spree.
Well, you're young again. Alan Dershowitz is a great friend of this show, and he is someone who has strong opinions on everything. His upcoming book is called The Case for Vaccine Mandates. Now, you didn't write this right after the president's speech, did you? You're writing it before.
I wrote it before. In fact, I have a chapter anticipating this called Who Decides? Is it up to the president? Is it up to Congress? Can the federal government do it? Must the state government do it? In the book, I pose all of these questions. Of course, since the president acted, I was able to sneak one more page into the book dealing directly with President Biden, and I'm doing an op-ed piece on Biden as well. So try to stay current.
Okay. In terms of what is going on, first of all, with the constitutional issue involved here, there are tons of prominent Republicans and opponents of the vaccines, frankly, who say that it is unconstitutional for the President of the United States to use federal power to try to impose a vaccine mandate. Do people have a good point about the constitutional prohibition?
They do. There are three constitutional questions, and they have to be separated, and all three have to be answered yes for the actions of President Biden to be constitutional. Number one, is this a federal issue or is it a state issue? After all, the states are given the police power. The Jacobson case is a state case. The states are entitled to mandate smallpox vaccines and probably a COVID vaccine. So is it state or federal? That's question number one. Question number two, if it's federal, can you mandate vaccines? Can you make people do something they don't want to do? And three, and I think this is the most important question, if one and two are answered yes, if the federal government can do it, and the federal government can make you do it, can the president make you do it? Is it something for executive authority as distinguished from legislative authority? And I think the answer to that is legislative authority.
Yeah, that legislative authority is more appropriate?
Not only more appropriate, it's constitutional. But remember, for the last 100 years, we've moved away from legislative authority. President Roosevelt locked up 110,000 American citizens in detention centers without express legislative authority. We have gone to war how many times now? Since the Second World War, in complete direct violation of the Constitution. Congress must declare war. Presidents say, well, we're not declaring war, we're just fighting it. So, you know, there's been a great expansion of presidential authority, which I think really undercuts democracy in many ways. And both Republicans and Democrats have objected to it when the opposite party is in power. So when Democrats are in power, the Republicans say, oh, executive monarchy. When the Republicans are in power, the Democrats complain about it. They complained about it mercilessly with President Trump. So there's a lot of hypocrisy on both sides. And the arguments that we've seen have been too broad. That is, the Republicans have been saying it's totally unconstitutional, and Democrats are saying it's totally constitutional. And the answer is, it depends. It depends on the answer to those three questions. And I suspect the court's going to duck the hard question, whether any government can ever compel you to take a vaccination against your wishes, even with exceptions, because they're going to say, if you can do that, you can only do it through legislative authority, not through executive mandates.
And what about the idea that there is no desire here to compel people to take a vaccination? It's to accept a vaccination as a condition of employment.
That's a subtle difference. Yeah. I mean, you know, what if we made vaccination a condition of voting or a condition of praying? Unconstitutional conditions still rise to the level of constitutional issues. So here we have the federal government, only the federal government, saying if you work for the federal government, if you contract with the federal government, if you have more than 100 employees, you must either make them be vaccinated or you must test them once a week. Now, the president's statement didn't have exemptions, but I'm sure the rule itself will have exemptions, clearly for medical reasons. Would it have exemptions for religious reasons? That's the question. I agree with you. There is a difference. I mean, plunging a needle into somebody's arm against their will is different from saying you can't get on an airplane unless you're vaccinated, you can't go to work unless you're vaccinated. The person still has the option of living in a bubble, whereas mandatory vaccination doesn't give them that option.
Okay, so in terms of the case for vaccine mandates, which is your new title, I would assume you are supportive, and I don't know, we haven't talked about this before, but I would assume you are supportive of what the president has just done.
No, I'm not. I'm supportive of, as a last resort, mandatory vaccination with exceptions and with due process as a last resort. But I'm not in favor of a president ordering people to be vaccinated as a condition of employment. I have mixed views on it. I'm very strongly in favor of vaccination. I think everybody should get vaccinated. I think it's selfish not to be vaccinated. I think, you know, John Stuart Mill's libertarianism basically says your right to swing your fist ends at the tip of my nose. Your right to not be vaccinated ends at the tip of my lungs. You cannot be vaccinated if you want to endanger yourself, but you can't endanger me. And so I'm in favor of conditioning access to certain places, either on masking or vaccination or social distancing. But I'm only in favor of mandatory vaccinations as an absolute last resort, and I'm not sure we're there yet.
And what would you believe we would have to experience, and how should it be handled? I mean, I assume that based upon the conversation we're having right now, Alan, that you believe that if we ever came to the point where this was a crisis and it was the only way potentially out of the pandemic and seeing a reduction in the pandemic, that you would favor a legislative or a joint legislative executive move rather than a purely executive move like President Biden has just done.
That's exactly right. I think for something as monumental as this, you need all three branches agreeing. You need the president not vetoing a legislative action, and you need the Supreme Court upholding it. And then, once you have the checks and balances at work, then you can really debate the issue of whether or not a vaccine mandate can ever be constitutional. But until we get to that issue, I'm not prepared to say that it's constitutional for the president unilaterally to do this. And remember, he says it's an emergency, but we've had COVID from the day he came into office, and we will have COVID from the day he leaves office, even if he serves two terms. We're going to have COVID for the next 100 years. It's going to be like the flu. Every season, it'll be different. You probably need booster shots. It won't any longer be a pandemic, but it'll be an epidemic. And it's not an emergency. It's something that should require thoughtful legislative hearings. Remember, too, the president admits it's not an emergency. You have 75 days to get vaccinated. That's a long period for an emergency.
That's right. And if you have 75 days, you have 75 days to have either some congressional approval or disapproval. There are some members of Congress who actually are planning to debate it. We will talk about that. We'll also talk about a parole of a very famous murderer. Where is Alan Dershowitz on Sirhan Sirhan? I have no idea, but we'll find out on the MedVed Show. Michael Medved Show, talking to one of the leading constitutional lawyers in recent U.S. history, Alan Dershowitz, who has taught law at Harvard for 48 books, actually. I knew that there was a 48 in there. And the most recent book is called The Case for Vaccine Mandates. Quick question about vaccine mandates, and then I want to just go off on a tangent on another moment, sure, if you don't mind. In terms of the vaccine mandates, it sounds like you would anticipate that the Supreme Court will hear the case about the appropriateness and the efficacy and the legality, frankly, and constitutionality of vaccine mandates on an expedited basis. Is there a chance that this could be heard quickly?
Very much so. Already some states, some employers, and some workers are contemplating lawsuits. This is going to be a bonanza of lawyers. And I think that there will be an attempt to enjoin the mandate, and I think the court will take it up. I think we'll have a preliminary decision within the month, I think.
Well, if there is an injunction against the mandates, wouldn't that actually probably discourage more people from getting the vaccine?
That's the problem. I mean, the problem is, you know, mandates sometimes get people's back up against the wall. I have no problem with the president using his bully pulpit, which he did, I think, quite effectively, you know, saying it's selfish not to have a vaccination and it should be done. And it's not only for your health, it's for the health of your neighbors, your friends, your relatives. But when you say the government's compelling you to do it, there are going to be some people who would otherwise get it and say, no, I'm just not going to do it if the government says I have to do it. So it's tricky, and I don't know what the right answer is. That's for public health officials and others. I only know the constitutional answer, and I don't think the Supreme Court is going to allow a massive mandate involving most American workers, essentially, when it's over, without legislative approval.
And that legislative approval, do you think there will be, with this very sharply divided Congress, that there would be? You don't know. No one knows.
Manchin. All you need is Manchin to say no, or Smith, or, you know, any one of those, you know, independents or people who have a streak of libertarianism in them, Democrats, they might say no. So it's hard to tell.
I think there will be several, and in fact, more than a dozen Republicans in both houses who will say yes.
It's very possible. You know, it's become so partisan that in the normal time you would find that. But other than Romney, are you going to get any Republicans who will do anything that Biden wants them to do? That's the real question. You know, this is the first time in my lifetime, I think in yours, that the a medical issue has become politicized. It wasn't politicized with polio. It wasn't politicized with smallpox, with measles.
No, it wasn't politicized with AIDS.
AIDS. Yeah, we all fought AIDS, yeah. But now everything is politicized. Look, Larry David screams at me on Martha's Vineyard saying I'm disgusting because I patted on the shoulder Mike Pompeo, who was my former student, with whom I worked in tandem on the Abraham Accords, on the peace process, on the recognition of Jerusalem. I will pat him on the back every time I see him. He did great work. But Larry David thinks that since I was in bed with Republicans, I am disgusting. He won't speak to me. He won't have anything to do with me. This is a guy whose kid I helped get into college, who I've done pro bono work for. That's the nature. You know, as I said, people have laughed at me. It's the Larry Davids of the world that will prevent the Democrats from winning the midterm elections. Americans are sick and tired of cancel culture, of people saying to others what you can think, what you can do, what you can say, and who you can vote for. And, you know, unless the Democrats begin to disassociate themselves from the Larry Davids of the world, they're going to be in deep trouble with middle America.
There's no question about it, and I agree with you completely, which brings me to one of the things that I'm not afraid to ask you about, because you're not a believer in cancel culture. Sirhan Sirhan, in June of 1968. I was there. He murdered Robert Kennedy. And he is now up for parole. It's going to go to the full parole board. It's been recommended by two parole officers. The Kennedy family is divided on whether he should be paroled or not after 53 years in prison. What says Alan Dershowitz about the appropriateness of leaving an apparently unrepentant murder out of jail because he's taken Tai Chi and he attends Alcoholics Anonymous meetings?
Well, there are better candidates for parole. I'm like the Kennedy family. I'm somewhat divided. I was working for Bobby. He had offered me a job in June of 1968. I was woken up in the middle of the night and I cried. It was one of the most horrible experiences ever. In fact, I was working for Bobby Kennedy's campaign on gun control at the time he was murdered. Let me tell you why, on balance, I'm opposed to it. I think they'll make a martyr of him. I think, remember, he's the first Palestinian terrorist, essentially. He's not a Muslim terrorist. He's Christian. But he was kind of the leading arm of terrorism, and you know, the Palestinians.
Yeah, and they've named a school after him in the Palestinian Authority. But go ahead.
Right, and look, six murderers escaped the other day. Two of them, fortunately, have been caught. But six escaped, and the Palestinians are praising them. And you imagine what will happen if Sharon is allowed out. He would become prime, not quite, but he'll become a hero, and he'll speak all over for terrorism because he's unrepentant. He doesn't even remember, he says, what he did. So although it's a hard question, I come out against it.
Okay, and back to the other hard question. And hard questions, what is the saying, make bad law? But are we going to get some kind of clear red line that is going to be drawn on when vaccine mandates are appropriate and when they are not?
It'll never be a clear line because the science is shifting, the medical data is shifting, the disease is shifting. But I think we'll get some very substantial guidance, and I think the guidance will be that the federal government does have jurisdiction. This is a disease that doesn't recognize state boundaries, and it's transmittable, and it involves interstate commerce. And I think there will be a ruling, if we ever get to that, that as a last resort, some degree of compulsion may be required, whether it's conditional or whether it's absolute. But I do think that the courts will say it has to be done through the usual democratic processes, not through presidential decrees or administrative agencies.
Then that would be an amazing thing, because it would be happening presumably at some point either at the outset or in the very dead middle of a decisive congressional campaign for 2022. Alan Dershowitz, he has an upcoming book. It is called The Case for Vaccine Mandates, but like most of his writing, it looks at both sides. It is subtle and ultimately profound. I can't wait to receive it, which I look forward to.
You're listening to a special broadcast of The Michael Medved Show as your cultural crusader is out today observing the holiday of Sukkot. Stick around. We got lots more coming up on The Michael Medved Show in this greatest nation on God's green earth.
Show. It's unfortunate that there are a lot of people who lived through September 11th who believe that you know everything about it. You don't. And one proof of that is a new book called American Phoenix. It's by Lincoln M. Starnes, who joins us on the line, together with his brother, my friend, former Lieutenant Colonel Benjamin W. Starnes of the U.S. Medical Corps, who is a very distinguished physician in Seattle. Lincoln Starnes, the author of the book, is a graduate of University of Virginia, and he is a longtime courier for FedEx. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me. The title of the book, American Phoenix, subtitle, Heroes of the Pentagon on 9/11. First, if you were to talk about one thing that most people don't know about those hours surrounding the Pentagon slaughter, and it was a slaughter, what is the most important thing for people to keep in mind about that aspect of the terror attack of 9/11?
Link, do you want to
like
me to,
do you want answer me to that question, that? Michael?
Sure. Go ahead, Link.
I would say that it was the fact that the entire place was thrown into darkness. These people were, they couldn't see a thing. The only thing they had to go on was the voices of the people that were leading them, trying to lead them out of the building. Because as soon as the plane hit, it caused the electrical wiring to be severed, and you had all kind. You know, you had gallons of jet fuel thrown everywhere. You had smoke. You had a real dangerous environment in there, and someone had to go in and shut the power down, and that just plunged the entire building into darkness. So, I think that was one of the most incredible things: is that people got out of there and they were actually saved, you know, in the darkness and not knowing where to go or how to get out.
Ben, Dr. Starnes, you were one of those people who rushed to the scene and confronted that darkness. What was that scene like when you glimpsed it for the first time?
So thank you, Michael, and it's really a pleasure to be on your show. I was 7 miles away at Walter Reed seeing my vascular surgery clinic when I got the phone call from the assistant chief of surgery asking me to go to the emergency room and get on a bus because the Pentagon had been hit by a plane. And getting through the city was very chaotic. And it's detailed in the book, American Phoenix, little known events. When I got there, our bus driver was quite anxious, and he dropped us off right next to the wall of the Pentagon where the flames were burning. And we actually had to walk away from the heat because the heat was so intense. One of the things that I saw there that was unusual was a fire truck that was on fire. And I thought to myself, this is really unusual. Did the fire company get too close to the fire? I mean, is this a common thing? No, it was, that fire truck was parked there by a man named Alan Wallace, who was a firefighter at the Pentagon. And that was normal routine for when the president was going to be landing Marine One at that helicopter pad. And so that fire truck was engulfed in flames once the plane hit the wall.
There was actual rescue of, and this is some of the most riveting parts of American Phoenix, the new book by Lincoln and Ben Starnes. The rescue, how did that happen? There was no one rescued from on board the plane, but there were people who had been at their offices at the Pentagon. Is that right?
That's correct. There were 184 people killed at the Pentagon. There would have been much more. You have to understand that the Pentagon is the world's largest office building, 6.6 million square feet. That's larger than the square footage of both towers in New York combined. And the wedge that was hit in the Pentagon was actually undergoing renovation. And fortunately, there were only about 800 people in that wedge when there normally would be about 4,500. And so that was very fortunate. But, you know, there are people like Tony Rose, Sergeant Major Tony Rose, Staff Sergeant Christopher Brayman, Lieutenant Colonel Marilyn Wills. These were the heroes of the Pentagon. They were going back in to the Pentagon to rescue their coworkers and their friends repeatedly. It was really, really, you know, these stories, Michael, need to be told. They need to be read, and they, you know, I think particularly now, during this pandemic, we need these stories of inspiration.
You write about people actually getting people to jump and catching them in their arms. Explain how that worked.
Well, if you're talking about Craig Powell, the Navy SEAL, who stood down in the A&E drive and caught people as they were coming out of the second floor. And Powell had his legs severely damaged. And one woman jumped from the, they basically pushed her, had to push her out of the second story, and she weighed more than 300 pounds, and she hit him on the side of the leg, a glancing blow, and he continued to catch people as they came out. It was just, he worked through the pain, you know, and there were a lot of people like that. They just mentally, you know, it proves that strength is mental. They basically just mentally willed their way through it, even though they were in extreme pain.
And during this time, you were beginning to give medical treatment to some of the people who were burned, seriously injured. Talk about that, Ben.
Yes. So I was one of the only surgeons at Walter Reed at the time that had recent combat experience, and I think that's why Lieutenant Colonel Goff called me to lead a team to the Pentagon. And, you know, what we did on the bus is we basically, I divided everyone into different categories. So we had a pathologist and a pharmacist that I put in charge of the expectant category. The U.S. Army and the military has a triage system called DIME. It's delayed, immediate, minimal, and expectant. The expectant are those who are expected to die, and they just need comfort measures only. The delayed and the minimal are the walking wounded, if you will, people with lacerations, broken bones. They're going to survive, but they don't need immediate care. And obviously the immediate are those who need control of hemorrhage immediately or securement of an airway, that sort of thing. And so we divided into groups, physician groups, and we basically began to set our facility up the whole time expecting to receive casualties. We treated several casualties on site as soon as we got there, and the goal there was just to scoop and run. We put those casualties into ambulances and sent them to the nearest hospital. And then we began to set up our triage categories, and we began to prepare for casualties to come out. And the reality is that not many casualties came out after that point. And all of that was combined with the fact that there were a couple of occasions where we were alerted that there was another plane unaccounted for, and that was Flight 93, and that was inbound into our area. And so, yeah,
which is an amazing part of the story that again people should read. This is one of those TikTok stories where it unfolds minute by minute, and you see the way it unfolded in the different characters who emerge here, all of whom were eyewitnesses of the Pentagon terror attack. The book American Phoenix: Heroes of the Pentagon on 9/11. The author Lincoln Starnes with his brother Benjamin W. Starnes. God bless you both, and thank you for your service. We will be right back on the MedVed Show. Often there are people who work for the government or for various institutions, and you can use the term accurately for many of those people, public servant. There are people who work hard, face all kinds of crises, all kinds of difficulties. Right now, the difficulty of keeping one of the world's largest religious seminaries open and operating for enlightenment in the midst of a pandemic. Al Mohler's been busy with that. He is the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, It is the flagship school of the Southern Baptist Convention and one of the largest seminaries in the world. He's also the author of the essential book, The Gathering Storm, Secularism, Culture, and the Church. Al, it's great to talk to you. I trust everyone in your world as well.
They are. Thank you, Michael. And I hope the same in yours. Good to talk with you.
That's great to talk to you again. And as you, this piece you wrote about Joe Biden is just a blockbuster. And it's the title. It's not the kind of press that Joe Biden wants, but it's the kind of press he's been getting and earning all over the place. It is entitled A Profile of Moral Collapse, President Biden, Abortion, and the Culture of Death. And it sounds like you have been following Joe Biden for going on 50 years. Would that be about right?
Pretty close. I mean, my adult life and Joe Biden's public life pretty much overlap, and I've seen it as kind of a test case. By the way, my political prophecy meter's clearly off because, 10 years ago, there's no way I would have believed that Joe Biden would be president of the United States, but here we are. But he's been on a trajectory of compromise after compromise on issues that he said were a principle. And given the leftward direction of the Democratic Party and of its leadership, the leadership and the culture towards abortion, he had to make some shifts. He just made them in a big hurry.
What I didn't realize until I read your piece, and we're going to link it up to our website at michaelmedved.com, was I knew that he was for the Hyde Amendment, which blocked using federal funds to fund abortions. I knew he was for it. I knew he had voted for it. But you have quotes in here where this is like a matter of first principle for him. This is something that he says is religious. And then he changed in 24 hours. How'd that happen?
Well, it's interesting that people think of the Northeast, and they think of it as a very secular part of the country, and it is. But Joe Biden's been in politics. He was elected to the Senate in 1972. At that time, you still had a huge Roman Catholic vote northeastern states or in mid-Atlantic states like Delaware. And he needed those votes. He always identifies and frankly puts in the word devout, which... again, just raises the stakes. But he is in direct conflict with the official teaching of the Roman Catholic Church. But he's tried to cloud that. But you're right. He supported the Hyde Amendment and has bragged about the fact that he did it more than 50 times. And he went on to explain why, saying that it's morally wrong to compel people who don't believe in abortion to pay for them. He made the case over and over again. And even in June of 2019, he said, as he was running for the Democratic nomination in 2020, he said, "I support the Hyde Amendment." It was real clear in the aftermath of that he was going to have to change his position if he wanted to get within, 100 yards of the Democratic nomination. He changed it in 24 hours. And in 24 hours, just came out and completely reversed himself on the Hyde Amendment. I wrote this article, Michael, because now he's reversed himself on the issue of when human life begins.
Right, which was his whole basis that he put forward. He said he took the faithful teaching of the Catholic Church that human life began at time of conception, and he defended that, and he said he'll never change on that because that's a matter of principle with him.
It's de fide teaching of the Roman Catholic Church. It's not just a teaching. It is de fide, which means it's defined as central and essential for Catholics to believe.
Okay, so he's changed that with regard to the new Texas abortion law, is that right?
That's right. He made a comment in which he came out and said, and this was last Friday, he said, quote, "I respect those who believe life begins at the moment of conception. I respect that. Don't agree, but I respect that." Don't agree? That's the point. He's disagreeing with himself again.
He has in his autobiography, which I didn't know, but thank God you read, Al. In his memoirs, he talks about this being one of his core beliefs, life beginning.
Absolutely.
So how do you turn around on your autobiography, your own testament, and just flip it so easily? Yeah.
Michael, you've been observing politics for a long time. And so a politician kind of shifting a position and trying to do it in a slippery way so that someone notices, you've been onto that for decades. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a man who has proudly identified himself in every way possible as Roman Catholic, and has premised his entire adult life on at least agreeing with the Roman Catholic Church about the sanctity of human life. But now, all of a sudden, without any announcement, he just completely reverses himself. So, and as I say, on a de fide that is essential to the faith teaching of his church, you know, this is a hollow man. This is not just someone changing a position on offshore, you know, oil exploration. This is about the dignity and sanctity of human life.
Which is, and again, the strength of his statements about the dignity and sanctity of human life, that's what I had no idea of before I read your piece. Let me ask you this, because we're going through this incredible mess in Texas, and there's a Mississippi case coming up first before the Supreme Court. What do you think is the best outcome for our country and for the cause of human life? In terms of that particular law and the pending court cases?
Yeah, the Mississippi case is the most important. The Texas case is right before us because it's a law in effect, and you know, even the Attorney General just came out minutes ago to make a public statement about it. But the Mississippi case is the one that, as you say, is arriving on the docket of the Supreme Court in a matter of weeks. And it's a direct confrontation with Roe v. Wade. What I hope for is a reversal of Roe v. Wade, which, as you know, doesn't mean that abortion would then be illegal in every state. It would return the question to the states. And I think both, first of all, on behalf of human life, and then also on behalf of a sane reading of the Constitution, that's a significant step towards health.
Well, especially because you have to look really, really hard to find the word abortion in the Constitution.
I'm still looking.
Yeah, it is so peculiar. And when you read the Griswold case, which, of course, Roe is based on,
right,
and they talk about an emanation of a penumbra of the Eighth Amendment and the 14th Amendment, I mean, it's made up. And the whole idea of our system is consent of the governed.
You're right.
It's
and
the,
they admitted
the people
at the
get
time,
to make
as
it.
You know, that they were making it up.
Yeah, because how could you not? Do you believe that there will be a majority? They probably won't eliminate Roe and overturn it per se, but give the states much, much more latitude in terms of limiting abortion during the second and third trimester.
No,
isn't that the most likely?
I do, Michael, and I think one of the ways the court can do this is by rejecting the trimester division that Roe had put into place and allowing the states to push back the question of legal abortion to when they can define, like you have in the Mississippi law, a heartbeat, a cardiac activity. And now, as a pro-lifer, that's not enough for me, but that would be a very significant step. That would basically outlaw most abortion in the United States, or at least I should say, it would allow states to legislate, and like right now in the state of Texas, eliminate most abortions.
Well, again, what we're talking about is going back to the Constitution and not to the will of, a group of, getting on in years people. Al Mohler, not getting on in years, president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, author of The Gathering Storm, and always a guiding light. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to a replay of The Michael Medved Show. Your cultural crusader is out observing the Jewish holiday of Sukkot. He will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, we've got two more hours coming up. We're going to feature Rich Lowry of National Review, George Will, who has an awesome new book, as well as some recent news stories that are still very timely and fascinating and entertaining. So thanks for hanging with us today in this greatest nation on God's green earth.